Note the Vibes. Welcome back to another episode of the Hoop Genius Podcast, brought to you by NBA 2K25. It is myself, Mo Mutsi, and joining me today, not one, but two of the most elite trainers in the entire NBA. Of course, you guys know CT Christopher Thomas here with us. We're making his debut on the show, live and direct from New York City. You know, we were lucky because had the Knicks won that game, maybe he'd be out in the streets partying. But Mr. David Zenon is here with us. How you doing, fellas?
All good, my man.
Yes, sir. That's what we love to hear. What a crazy night in the NBA. If you guys at home haven't watched the game, you need to go back and watch at least the final 3 minutes of the fourth quarter and then overtime, because the Indiana Pacers walked into Madison Square Garden and stole game one on the road. And I say stole. They won 138 to 135. And I say stole because if it wasn't for Mr. Aaron Nesmith catching fire, turning into a human flamethrower, as the commentator described him, in the final 3 minutes, this show would be completely different. Because I was ready to go on a rant here because the Pacers were not playing Indiana Pacers basketball. And the biggest mistake that the Pacers made was they couldn't succeed in the minutes where Jalen Brunson was on the bench. Jalen Brunson picked up his fifth foul early in the fourth quarter, and yet the Knicks just carried on rolling. OGs hitting buckets, Cats hitting shots. They even had in earlier in the game, they even had Campaign coming and hitting shots. But none of that matters anymore, because in the playoffs, once the game is done, it's done, and you're on to the next one. And fellas, the final 3 minutes, right? The Knicks were up by 14 with 2 minutes, 51 seconds to go. Aaron Nesmith hit, what did he hit? Six threes? Six?
He went crazy.
Yeah.
David, let me get a word, because you do a lot of work with guys on their shot form in particular, right? Mm-hmm. You're a mastermind when it comes to the jump shots. When you're down 14 and the game is almost done, like the crowd's ready to leave the arena, so on and so forth, how are these guys staying so locked in? Because it's a mental thing. There's a lot of guys out there who wouldn't be locked in to make those shots, let alone have the urgency to play at that level right down to the buzzer.
Yeah, I think they did a good job of going back to their identity with the tempo. I also noticed a little bit where the Pacers went to flex to a handoff, and they were doing a lot of stuff, taking advantage of Cat and the drop. I think that also helps in terms of getting a rhythm in your three-point shot. So if the coaching staff is in your ear telling you, hey, if you have that shot, take it, and clearly Indiana likes to play that type of style of basketball, you know, there's no time that Indiana's out of a game with the three-point shot being the equalizer. So, yeah, Nesmith took advantage of that big time.
Absolutely, because it's two contrasting styles. You know, the Knicks like to play quite a slow brand of basketball. The Pacers are all about getting out there and running. Even off made shots, they inbound the ball as fast as they can. They get out there and they go. But, CT, what was going through your head in the final seconds of regulation when Tyrese Haliburton beats his defender on the perimeter, drives to the paint, sees Mitchell Robinson, decides to turn around and run back out to the three-point line and shoot over Mitchell Robinson? What was going through your mind at that point?
I've seen it before. Deja vu. Like, he's done that a couple times, not only this season, but in his career with the Pacers so far. So it's just one of those is like, oh, God, foul him. Like, do something else other than let him get that shot up. And he does that. Like, he does that. Like, it's not his first time doing that.
The Knicks were up two at that point, and it's kind of crazy that he had the, I don't know what the word is to say, this is a family-friendly show, the cojones to go and run back to the three-point line and shoot that three. And it was a Kevin Durant-type shot in reference to when Kevin Durant hit the shot against the Bucks and his foot was just on the line, so it was a two, not a three. And then we go to overtime. But I don't know if he knew that, because he was doing the Reggie Miller. He was giving them the choke celebration. Maybe it was a little bit too early.
The funny part, that was Kevin Durant toe on the line. That was Kawhi bounce, high bounce, suspended time and went in. And then he does the choke. Like, had a lot of symbolism there.
If you guys were wondering, 23 points for the Pacers in the final 3:14 of regulation. That's the most in the final 3 minutes, 14 seconds in the regulation of a playoff game in the play-by-play era. So since 1997. And tonight was the first time ever that a team up by 14 or more points in the final 2 minutes, 50 seconds of the fourth quarter in a playoff game or overtime went on to lose the game. Before tonight, teams were 977 and 0.
What?
Teams were 977 and 0, being up 14 with less than 3 minutes to go in a playoff game. Until Neesmith and Halliburton tonight. Hey,
Neesmith. Saved them on both ends, defensively. Just being a bugaboo, being the physical, dominant, on-ball defender. And then the shots he was hitting, the threes he was hitting, were like, okay, that's tough. That's tough, tough.
Mm. You know, defensively, the Pacers are in a tough spot here because Jalen Brunson once again went off for 43 and Karl-Anthony Towns had a huge game. He was looking really aggressive really early on, in contrast to what happened in the previous series. He finished with 35, but the Pacers did a good job with limiting the role players of the New York Knicks. You know, OG had 16, but he only had six up until the fourth quarter. Josh Hart had eight, Bridges had 16 as well. If you guys were game planning to go up against the New York Knicks, would you be happy for Brunson and Towns to run up the scoring and try and limit the role players, or would you try and limit the superstars and potentially dare one of the role players to come out and beat you?
I think it's a catch 22 with them. It's difficult because OG is way more talented on the offensive. I mean, obviously, we know he's a capable three-point shooter. Defensively, he is a monster. And Mikal has done wonders for them with their defensive ability and then also his mid-range scoring opportunities. So it's kind of like pick your poison with them. But clearly, you could see JB is the head of the snake. Cat follows suit. If those two are kind of taken off of their game, you might have an opportunity where OG can go crazy, but that's obviously you're rolling the dice on that. So to answer your question, you'd have to let those two go crazy and allow the other three to beat you. And also, let's not lose the fact that Deuce McBride has shown up huge in this year's playoffs. So he's a big option for them off the bench. They don't have a lot of depth, but they have impactful players off the bench. So that's something that you can take advantage of them having that.
Absolutely. CC, what are your thoughts?
I think some of the same. I think the Pacers' pace is a problem for the Knicks that don't go deep in the bench. And today was, well, the game, Brunson had more rest time in game than he had all season. So and they're Kat obviously trying to save him from having to run up and down at that pace, which might be the problem. Like, the Pacers go deep in the bench. They play out, you know, make or miss. They're getting that thing past timeline and into early offense real quick, real fast. That's hard to stick with a 7-man, 8-man rotation. And I think the Knicks, you saw they had three players off the bench that hadn't played much, if any, in playoffs. They're going to have to resort to that because the Pacers are going to come at them. And now they got the secret sauces. Brunson had his 40-point game. Karl-Anthony Towns had a 30-plus point game, and they still lost.
I was almost in disbelief, not the three-point shooting or the potential game winner. I was in disbelief when I saw Dillon Wright check into the game because at this rate, I forgot he was even on the Knicks roster because he never gets any game time. But
so did he.
You know, campaign gave them good contributions. David, as you said, Miles McBride did his thing. Mitchell Robinson, you know, it doesn't show up in the stat sheet, but he is so impactful in what he brings to this Knicks team. And, you know, Brunson is a fantastic player. He's clearly their best player. But I don't know if the Pacers have to adjust their game plan as much as for Jalen Brunson, which is crazy to say, as when Mitchell Robinson comes into the game.
I think they do. I mean, he's an excellent screen. I know everybody's talking about the offensive rebounding, and that's been a total game changer for the Knicks. But, you know, they were getting Bridges open a lot with those high, wide pin downs from Robinson. And, you know, him being the pick-and-roll threat that he is, that put the Pacers in a little bit of a predicament. So little things that he does where it might not show up on the stat sheet. And then he had a steal. T.J. McConnell drove to the basket, good hands. Like little things like that. So, yeah, that's going to be the X factor, in my opinion, for this series, the double big lineup that they put out there. I want to see how Indiana counters that. But speed kills, so that's always something that you have to have in the back of your mind.
And this is the thing with speed, as my good friend BJ Armstrong loves to say, being speedy gets you into trouble, but also gets you out of trouble real quick. And we saw that tonight. The Pacers got into trouble, then they got out of trouble real quick with that one. You mentioned TJ McConnell there where Mitchell Robinson got a steal on him, but I thought he had some really good minutes as well. He gave them 10 points off the bench and just his ability to push the pace. And I don't know if anyone in the league right now uses that Nash dribble quite as well as he does when he goes to the baseline. And he's always looking to kind of score or dish off of that. And, that's something you'd think the Knicks would be ready for, because there was a stretch where I think he got like three straight buckets off that baseline dribble. And I'm looking at it like, guys, it's the conference finals. You know what he's trying to do. He's been doing it for years upon years upon years. Just looking at the next game, right? So you escape with this one. And I feel like the Pacers might feel a little bit lucky, because they had no business winning this game. Looking ahead to the next matchup, do you see them giving Brunson any different looks? Because Nesmith did a solid job guarding him. But whoever guards Jalen Brunson typically is going to end up in a lot of foul trouble. How would you manage that strategy? Who would you kind of throw at him to start the game? Then would you change it throughout the game? What would that be looking like if you were the coach?
I think they stayed the same strategy. Brunson almost fouled out himself. So they're making him play on both sides. And shoot, last series, he fouled out in the second half alone. So he's prone to some calls that he probably was getting in regular season, and now he's not getting that. I mean, Nesmith is being physical, he's been physical all playoffs for the Pacers, but it's different against Jalen, and then they both ended up with what, five fouls each? So that's a battle in itself, and that's a good battle. No one fouled out. Both were highly productive, highly important at the end of the game when it mattered. Let them play.
David, the Celtics in the previous series, they guarded Josh Hart with their bigs because they didn't consider him to be a shooting threat. Do you see the Pacers trying that with Miles Turner? And kind of using him for a little bit more rim protection, because the bulk of Jalen Brunson's scoring tonight, he only had one 3-pointer that went in, one of six from behind the arc. The bulk of his scoring was in the paint. Do you think that's a strategy they can go to with Miles Turner kind of sagging off Josh Hart, and then they put Nembhard on Josh Hart in this one? Because obviously he's a very pesky defender, but he doesn't kind of have the length and the size that Nesmith has guarding Brunson. But do you see them kind of going to that a little bit to try and slow down Brunson?
I mean, I think that the Knicks, they got comfortable with the drives early and them allowing to operate out of the paint from the inside out. I mean, they did hit a couple threes, but to mention your point, Miles Turner, not necessarily allowing Jalen or anybody else to shoot three for their switch. They're willing to allow those shots that you quote unquote live with. And they're a much better transition team than Boston is. So obviously, you know that their pace is going to be high. And the fact that the trail also it helps that Miles Turner is a trailing big that can shoot the three as well. So that's a game changer with how they're going to essentially allow Jalen to take those long threes, get long rebounds, operate. There's no rim runner outside of Obi Toppin. Maybe you have opportunity to shoot wide and deep, but that's something that's going to have to be fine-tuned by the Knicks. But I think they will. I mean, Tibbs is a good coach. He's going to figure out ways to help Jalen operate. But look at the fact that yes, Josh Hart is kind of being. Not targeted on the offensive end where it's like, yeah, you could shoot the ball. But if Mikhail is able to operate in the mid-range as well as he does, they could do a little bit more pick and pop with Cat. I think he was more aggressive with shooting threes tonight, so that might alleviate with, the pressure that's on Jalen. So that's something to take a look at as well.
And shout out to Obi Toppin, who you mentioned, because he had that the dunk that was kind of the dagger late in overtime. It was weird for me watching it as they inbound the ball. They were up one, right? They were up one, and the Knicks don't try and foul to stop the clock. There was like 20 seconds on the clock left. They don't try and foul, but they also don't try and play defense either. They didn't try and deny the inbounds. He got the inbounds, ran to the hoop and dunked with kind of nothing in his way. I
And
don't.
got fouled. He got fouled on
Yeah,
that.
that was an
Yeah,
and
he
one as
got,
well. They didn't call it, but I don't know what the Knicks were thinking in that play. Kind of game on the line, late game execution. Do you think stuff like that is a symptom of the pace, that you guys have talked about, that the Pacers play with, that by the time you get late in the fourth and to overtime that you kind of are more exhausted than you are in previous rounds?
I would think that was just a great play call. It was who's thinking of Obi Toppin getting the ball in that moment, especially with Halliburton on the court. So, great read, first of all, and then the fact that there was no rim protection was like, okay, you gotta go dunk that. So, but I think the pace that the Pacers play is gonna be a factor in the long run in this series.
No, for sure. It will. I think it will. I agree with you, CT.
The Pacers did their job. They stole home court advantage. They won game one on the road. You know, they split the first two games. That's the goal of every team going on the road for the first two games of a series. The question I have for you, gentlemen, is can they steal game two as well? What do you see happening in that one?
As a native New Yorker, we are hoping for a different outcome for game two. No, but in an unbiased sense, it's going to be really tough. The way they came out, they were up 8-0, I believe. Naismith started the game hot, very aggressive. When the Knicks' tempo slowed down, the Pacers' defensive intensity turned up. And that's something that might be a fatigue factor. Not saying that the Knicks are just going to get tired, but running 10 men, they go 10 deep no matter what. And now that Shepherd is kind of in the play, I think Carlisle's throwing a wrinkle into whatever game plan the Knicks have in terms of the defensive side. So that's something to keep an eye on. But yeah, game two, I'm a little interested. I'm not nervous. I'm interested. I mean, I'm a little interested about
That's the New York perspective. Let's get the Indiana perspective from CT.
it. I don't think the Knicks are in trouble. I mean, I think they've played a style of basketball that fits in the playoffs. They can come from behind. They can grind it out, obviously. They've got dependable players. As long as they stay healthy, don't get hurt, they'll be fine. I don't see them losing game two, but I can see the Pacers pressing them with nothing to lose, play 15 people and trying to just wear them out in game two to get back here to Indy for game three and be back home and comfy.
Yeah, it's kind of a psychological thing because in the previous series, the Knicks were the hunters. You know, the Celtics would build up these big leads and then the Knicks would hunt them down. They go now, game one against the Pacers, they're the ones who are being hunted because they build up the lead and the Pacers are the ones hunting them down. Maybe the Knicks have got so used to playing from behind and closing a deficit that they didn't know what to do when they were up big. But like you talk about the depth, like a guy that intrigues me for the Indiana Pacers that we didn't actually see tonight is Jairus Walker, who's given them very good defensive minutes in their regular season matchups. I wonder if we're going to see any minutes from him. Ben Shepherd, as you said, David, he didn't make a huge impact tonight, but we didn't see much of him in the last series. But when he's shooting that ball, he's another elite shooter that they can add to their roster. We saw a lot of Thomas Bryant as well through stretches. Whereas for the Knicks, it's kind of like you know what you're going to get. I like the versatility they have with. Even though it's a limited rotation compared to Indiana, you can run double bigs with Cat and Towns. You can go all defensive with Towns on the bench and Mitchell Robinson in the game, or you can go all offense with Cat at the five. It's going to be interesting to see what they do. We didn't see any Precious Achiuwa. I don't know if you guys saw Rick Carlisle's interview before game one, where he was
No, I
talking
didn't.
about how great Mitchell Robinson was, and then he threw Precious Achiuwa in, and he goes, "Oh, Precious Achiuwa is great," and so on and so forth, but it's a little bit of mind games because I feel like those precious minutes last time they matched up weren't a great look for the Knicks. But we didn't see him tonight. Maybe we see some minutes from him, but outside of that, I don't really see many other options that the Knicks can go to. But the Western Conference Finals are in full swing now after an exciting game one for the OKC Thunder. But before we get to that, we have to congratulate Mr. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander for winning his first ever MVP. Shout out to
Oh.
Shai. What a year for Converse. They got the MVP and the sixth man of the year, Payton Pritchard, rocking Converse. Who would have thought? But what are your guys' thoughts on the season that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander has just had?
Phenomenal.
Historical. Historical. I mean, it's Jokic. I would have been happy if Jokic would have got it. I'm not mad that Shea got it. They both stood out amongst all of the NBA. I mean, it was a two-man race for the majority of the season, which is odd to have happen. That, you know, for it to turn into a two-man race that early in the season, even before All-Star break, and then after All-Star break, it's solidified. It's only those two. That's pretty good. So, good kudos to him. He deserves it. He's tough. He's just tough.
You know, he's put up crazy numbers. Both of them, Jokic and Shea, put up crazy numbers. But obviously, the OKC Thunder having such a great dominant regular season and racking up all those wins obviously helped his case. But we know all about the narrative stuff. David, can you give us a technical breakdown of what makes Shea such a great player? Because some of the things that I see him doing, some of the angles that he can get to, is just insane.
His change of pace is out of this world. I love watching him play. I mean, I get it. I mean, the whole thing with the narrative and, you know, people with the free throws and all this other stuff. But when you play the game, and anybody who knows this, like, that plays for a long time, fatigue is a factor. You still have to make your free throws. You still have to be able to get to the paint in order to get those foul calls or whatever. However, his ability to get others involved without not necessarily even just racking up assist numbers, but the attention. I mean, you have to help. You have to show. Very rarely does he make mistakes once he plays off of 2 feet in the paint. His footwork is great. And he's bringing back that mid-range, man. I love the fact that he is smooth. He plays off of his screens really well, and he has a really good – you could tell a good rapport with guards and bigs. He's got that, man. I love the fact that they've been able to let him shine this season, and they have the best record for a reason. And yeah, man, I think he helped a lot of players get better and open opportunities. They did a lot of shooting with the threes. Their field goal percentage was great, and that's a testament to him. So congrats to him, man. He's phenomenal.
Absolutely. The question is, though, can he do it again in game two against the Timberwolves tonight? Because, you know, the last game, the first half of it was real interesting. Then OKC did the OKC thing of just going on those dominant streaks where they put their foot on the gas and they don't look back. And before you know it, it's a double-digit lead. Anthony Edwards picked up a kind of twisted ankle, I guess, in the second quarter. And then down the stretch, in the fourth quarter, I don't think he made a shot. He kind of looked like a non-factor down the stretch, which was uncharacteristic for him. Do you guys think Ant is going to have a bounce-back game in game two?
He got no choice.
He's got no choice, but it's dependent upon his ankle, right?
But the T-Wolves got no chance if Ant can't be dominant because OKC can throw literally six different guys at him with the same amount of defensive pressure. That's tough on him. He's going to be dog tired at the back end of the series, either way it goes. And Shea was 2 of 13 in the first half. Couldn't tell because their defensive pressure, because other guys hitting shots, making plays. And then he's 30, pencil in 30, and it's just plus every night. He's been doing this all season for the last two seasons. Timberwolves are in trouble because they play well without Shea playing MVP well. And then when he does, it's over. It's just like last night. It was done. It was a wrap.
They have so many impactful defenders, you know, Caruso, Dort, Williams is great. J-Dub is a great defender as well. Case and Wallace. They have so many guys that they can throw at Anthony Edwards as well. And they did a great job in the second half of slowing down Julius Randle, who had a great first half. He had 20 in the first half, 8 in the second half. David, what's the key here for the Timberwolves to take down OKC in game two? Because from watching that second half, there's really not much they could do.
They got to rely, you know, I'm going to piggyback off what CT said. Ant needs to come out and have a big game, but they also have to rely on their own X factors, the Dante DiVincenzos of the world, Naz Reid, and Jay. You know, it's McDaniels. Like, it's one of those things where you see Dante was 2 for 9 in the first half, and you're like, they're all threes. They aren't allowing these guys to get comfortable when they ran off the three-point line. And if they do have a three-point shot, it's always contested. So that's something where you're like, give or take, you know, Julius had a monster first half and he kept them in the game. But then you got to think to yourself, well, if he doesn't have that, where would the Timberwolves have been without that? So that's something to kind of really, really focus on, where it's like, hey, Dante, J-Mac, Nas, we're going to need you to step up here.
You know, while I got you guys here, because you're in the gym with these guys who are playing in the league. So I have to ask this on behalf of a lot of the fans who kind of watch this and wonder. The Timberwolves were, you know, reminiscent of my Boston Celtics with their reliance on that 3-point shot. When you get to off-season workouts now, how much of that is players coming in saying they want to work on their three ball, and how much do they actually work on the counters to it? Because when those shots aren't falling, I know they're capable of creating baskets another way, but we just never see it out there on the court.
Yeah, from my perspective, all my guys and women, we work on it's the elbow, the pull-up, the Kobe kill spots. No one guards that spot. So today's NBA is shoot the three, not even go to the rim anymore. It's everybody shoots the three. And so when you get chased off the three and you drag dribble stay for three, or you skate dribble stay for three, my training focus is okay, dribble pull up, get to a mid-range. And there's been this season in particular highly effective mid-range players of note that have kept themselves relevant without having to shoot the three. Shai Gilgeous is a prime example. He doesn't depend on the three to get 30 points a night, and it's phenomenal. He gets to the line as much as anybody, but the fact that his mid-range is on point, it's a testament to the three is a good thing if it's going in. But when it's not going in and you don't have a fix other than to keep shooting threes, that's not NBA basketball, but that's just not basketball.
Yeah, I agree with that. And for the off-season training that I do, I like to study the offenses of the teams that my players play for. I may talk to the coaching staff or the front office, or have the opportunity to do so and kind of break that down. But simple stuff, even when it's like when you're doing your warm-up or your shooting drills or your routines, it's not just one set of footwork that's involved. The right-handed shooter, left-right, left-handed, right-left. You want to switch it up. Hop, right-left, switch it up with how they approach. Because when you're in a game, and let's say someone shoots the gap, if you're so conditioned to just being a left-right, one dribble pull-up kind of shooter, where it's like, well, this is all I work on, you don't have a shot anymore. So little things like that, where you're like, if you shot 38% from three from, the left side of the floor, that at some point or another, they're going to force that ball and they're going to sit on one hand. We're going to work on that. So that's something that the off season is, it's imperative, where it's like, you don't want to waste time being in the gym doing stuff that requires you to dribble the ball too much and waste dribbles. You just got to be efficient. And, I'm pretty sure CT can attest to this. Whenever you're told your role, especially within a system in today's NBA, and the WNBA is kind of leaning towards this, if it's either at the rim or a 3-point shot, well, everything in between, most likely you're coming off of a screen. And that one dribble pull-up is going to be your bread and butter. It might not be the sexiest thing. It might not be what analytics want, but it's necessary. So that's what I focus on in the offseason, where I tell those guys, this is what we're going to fix or work on.
So you guys are working on these counters to when guys are getting chased off the 3-point line. The players are working on the counters. Why don't we see more of it in these games when teams go cold from behind the arc?
Prisoner of the moment, like it's today's NBA. Like it's fast breaks, people run out to the corner three instead of diving into off the 45 to the rim on the running lanes. So it's so ingrained that that 3-point shot is so valuable that it's hard in games. You see it with your own Celtics, like they just. They won by the three, and they literally lost by like lost a series by they just would not stop shooting three.
Yeah, I mean, and also this, to the Celtics point too, game one and two, they blew both, big leads, where it's like, okay, clearly the offensive rebound, the immediate kick out should be something where you reset. And they went straight to catch and it's up. And it's like you have a lead. Like I think that's some one of those things where it's like, hey, let's go back to like, the basics of basketball. If we're trying to, milk the clock, allow the team to, that's down by 16 at that point to now, oh, we're down by 12. Oh, wait, now we're down to 8. Let's try to slow this game down a little bit. So yeah, it's prisoner of the moment. I think that a lot of players that don't work on the counters off the 3-point line, they get stuck in that role where it's just like, all right, well, you're just going to go to the corner because that's exactly what every team is going to do.
Well, gentlemen, I know you both have early workouts to get to, so I want to thank you guys for coming through to the show today. Before we go, David, where can the people check you out and if they want to find more of your stuff? Because David actually has one of the most inspirational stories of his career. If maybe one day we'll get the chance to tell it on the show, but he has a real inspirational story and he does great work with a lot of your favorite players. So where can the people find you at?
David Mark Zenon, full name, on Instagram. And I'm picking up the Twitter thing again. I think I'll be back on Twitter.
You need to be.
I need to,
Playoff
go
time is the best time in the world to be on Twitter because the memes that just come out of
ahead.
everything, man, it's, I've been laughing for hours.
Hey, listen, man, I had a huge following at one point with Nick's Twitter, and it got crazy at some point. So I was like, you know what? I'm going to get off of it. But now that I see, I need to get back on the wave with Twitter.
100%.
But no, but David Mark Zenon at Instagram, I'll post some tutorials here and there. But for the most part, just I love the game. I love the game of basketball. So I want to be able to help teach the game and be a, a student of it as well.
Absolutely. CT, where can the people catch you?
I'm on Instagram, number one world dominator. And then catch me here.
We got two
That's
extremes.
all
We
we
got
need.
the full government name, and then we've got the world dominator. We got two
You
extremes
can't
right
get
here.
better than that. Come on, you can't get better than that,
We got
Mark.
it
Come
all.
on, man.
We got it all right here. Anyway, I appreciate you, fellas. You guys at home, make sure you subscribe to the show, YouTube, Spotify, Apple, wherever you get your podcast from. And until next time, get buckets.